Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, an analyst on that bizarre propaganda video from ISIS narrated by a British hostage.
But first, 6 years and trillions of dollars later, the Federal Reserve today is widely expected to end its bond buying program known as quantitative easing. The Fed has used that stimulus to prop up a flagging U.S. economy for years. But with unemployment now below 6% and other signs of economic growth, policymakers appear ready to change course. Diane Swank keeps a close eye on the Fed. She's chief economist at Mesirow Financial in Chicago. Diane, welcome back.
Thank you.
And is this really it? We've been talking about the end of the Fed's stimulus program for some time now, but it appears we're finally here.
I think they are going to end, certainly, the large-scale asset purchases today, but they'll still leave that crack of a window open to be able to start back in again if something were to fall apart, particularly given some of the instability we've seen in Europe and all the market gyrations we've seen of late. I think it's important that the Federal Reserve also expects to continue to hold its balance sheet at the same level, $4.4 trillion. They want to, anything that matures off the balance sheet, they're going to buy back and replace it on their balance sheet and hold it steady until they actually start raising rates. So from their perspective, they are still providing support for the economy that way.
And when you say that they're going to hold their balance sheet until they start raising rates, how long do you think that will be?
You know, that's the million-dollar question. I think they're going to wait until late in the third quarter of 2015. I hope they have to do it sooner because we have a stronger economy. But one of the concerns I have is, although labor market conditions appear to have improved a bit, we still have very low inflation, something that really came out in the cost of living adjustment for seniors and things like your Social Security benefits, disability benefits. That low inflation is now starting to become more worrisome for the Fed, and it's something that they're going to highlight today as well. And they much rather be gradual. So they're walking sort of, even though the economy hopefully is firming and the ground in which we walk on is firming, they're going to act as if they're walking on thin ice and be very careful how they raise rates and do it gradually, because the worst mistake they feel they can make, and the history tells us this, that if you move too soon after a financial crisis, even though we're 6 years in now, if you move too soon, you can have much worse consequences without a lot of a safety net to try to do anything about it later on. So
well,
that's
in fact,
really where they're at.
Some people are worried not just about low inflation, but deflation, prices falling. We spoke recently to the former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, who said this.
Deflation, not inflation, is the greater risk today. Not enough spending, not overspending, is the greater risk today.
Do you agree with that, Diane Swank?
Well, it is certainly the risk. And I think, you know, it's a fat tail risk, we call it. And it's one that you don't see happen very often. But we've seen a lot of things that we don't see happen very often in the last 7 years. So we have to consider it. And the Fed has to hedge the downside. And at the moment, inflation continues to decelerate. And you do have a real risk of deflation abroad. And those, along with a strong dollar, all raise the ante on the Fed not reaching its target of 2% inflation. And, you know, it's really difficult. I understand how people feel about, you know, hey, they're getting 1.7% on their Social Security, about $20 a month, and their basket of goods is not, they don't get the benefits of falling prices at the pump. That's great news for consumers who drive to work every day, but if you're retired, you're not getting that benefit, and you're paying for things like prescription drugs and food at the grocery store and shelter, which are going up more rapidly than that $20 a month. So it really is showing the tensions that we face of a low inflation environment.
As you look back now, 6 years after this stimulus program went into effect, how well did it work? Are there lessons to be learned?
Oh, there's probably a million and one lessons to be learned for some time to come. It wasn't as effective as I think the Fed had hoped. Part of that's because there was, you know, corralling of cats within the Federal Reserve, and their messaging wasn't always clear because they didn't always agree. And so there was dissonance coming out of the Fed. And part of the effectiveness of the kind of policies we're talking about requires very clear communication. And sometimes seeing the sausage being made, it's not very clear.
Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial in Chicago. And we will keep an eye on this because it's 2 o'clock today that we're going to find out what exactly the Fed plans to do. But the expectation, as Diane said there, is to end that stimulus program, the bond buying program known as quantitative easing. Diane, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, on the tape, he looks like a war correspondent. He is, in fact, a British reporter, but he's also a hostage. You've probably seen the ISIS video of British reporter John Cantley.
Hello, I'm John Cantley, and today we're in the city of Kobani on the Syrian-Turkish border. That is, in fact...
Cantley was kidnapped along with American journalist James Foley nearly 2 years ago. Of course, Foley was beheaded by ISIS, as was another American journalist, Steve Sotloff, British aid worker David Haynes, and Alan Henning, a taxi driver from the UK who went to Syria to bring aid to those affected by the civil war. He was also kidnapped by ISIS. Seth Jones is director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. We want his view of this video. Seth, welcome.
It's great to be on. Thanks, Robin.
Except it's so disturbing to see this. What do you make of this video?
I think what ISIS is trying to do here, and this gets to a broader trend we're seeing among a number of insurgent groups, particularly ISIS, is they usually use their own fighters for messaging. But in this case, they're using a hostage, somebody who is a journalist himself, somebody who's clearly under some form of coercion, but using him to get out what is a broader message about ISIS's efforts to take a city, take a major city.
Well, and to send the message that they've taken the city, which people are arguing. I mean, they're saying it's a mop-up operation, but what is actually going on in Kobani?
Well, there appears to be pretty substantial fighting right now by ground forces, including Peshmerga, that have gone into fight in Kobani, airstrikes, including by U.S. forces. So pretty serious street battles going on. But part of this issue, as we're seeing, is an information campaign. I think what ISIS is trying to do is to use a hostage here, a British journalist, to get a message across that it's won, to attempt to get almost a domino effect so that people will give up, the U.S. will focus elsewhere, and it can take the city.
You mentioned the Peshmerga fighters. There are Syrian Peshmerga fighters. There are also Iraqi, Kurdish Peshmerga fighters from Iraq that traveled through Turkey. They've arrived in Kobani, so they've come to support the other Kurds there, fighting going on. Do you think, as some have speculated, that the release of this video was in some response to a huge New York Times piece that detailed just how much these hostages had been tortured, waterboarded, James Foley and others, before they were killed? Some sort of effort to show, oh, here's a hostage who's alive and is siding with us, which nobody believes.
I don't think the only reason ISIS would put a video like this together is to show that someone's not being tortured. The focus of the message appears to be to get an information campaign out that ISIS is winning in Kobani, and that it's worth the Turks, the Iraqis, the Americans, and other allied forces to move elsewhere.
Well, in that vein, he's sarcastic. He taunts the West, again, using the ISIS script, we're presuming. He mocks Western reports that say ISIS is retreating from Kobani. Let's listen to another clip.
Now, good old John Kerry doesn't seem to think the Mujahideen are retreating. He called Kobani a horrible example of the unwillingness of people to help those who are fighting the Islamic State. That's a dig at Kurd-hating Turkish President Erdogan.
So, Seth Jones, a couple things that we're hearing there. What are you hearing there?
Certainly one thing that I'm hearing in the video is the use of the term Mujahideen. One of the reasons you'd use that is not to call or depict ISIS as terrorists or insurgents even, but as holy warriors. I mean, Mujahideen is the term that was used by the U.S. government to support anti-Soviet forces in Afghanistan in the 1980s. It's a term that doesn't have the negative connotations that a terrorist was.
And then there also seems to be the shout-out to remind Kurds, perhaps, that the Turkish president has not sent Turkish troops in to help support Kobani because, of course, it's Kurds that are fighting for that city. And there's been a long-standing Kurdish uprising in Turkey. So reminding people of that as well.
One of the purposes of the statements really about the Turks does appear to be to try to create some fissures between the Kurds who are fighting against ISIS in towns like Kobani and the Turkish government.
Well, as you said, that seems not to have worked, at least because we see the Kurds coming from Iraq to support the Kurds in Syria against ISIS. Overall, what are analysts like you doing with this video? Does it Can you compare it to others in the past? Can you gauge its impact on potential ISIS fighters?
Well, what's particularly interesting about the war in Iraq and in Syria right now that ISIS is fighting is, more than almost any other war we've seen in the modern era, militant groups are using media technology for a whole range of reasons, to recruit fighters, to get money, and then to get messages out. And in this case, what we see with John Cantley is the use of a hostage, somebody who speaks fluent English, in fact, is a Westerner, in fact, is a journalist, to try to get a message out that paints the insurgents, the terrorists here, as holy warriors, that paints them as winning, and that tries to sow discord between its enemies, between the Turks and the Kurds, between the Turks and the Americans. But it's the use of media technology like this, because I think what ISIS has been growingly concerned about is the 24-hour news coverage that comes from CNN, that comes from Fox News, that comes from Al Jazeera, and it's trying to compete in a broader marketplace of ideas. I mean, this clearly is an example that the struggle in Iraq and Syria right now is not just a battlefield, but it's a fight for ideas in the broader media world.
Is there any way of gauging whether or not this is effective with the lost souls who, you know, seem to be picking up rifles from around the world to join ISIS fighters?
In a broader context, I think this message is getting to individuals. On my recent trip into Afghanistan, there are Afghans and Pakistanis who have gone from already active battlefields into Syria and Iraq to fight with ISIS because they view this organization, more than almost any other jihadist group in the world, as actually making significant progress on a major battlefield against what they consider a major infidel regime backed by the United States. So in a broader context, it is convincing some individuals to come to this area to fight.
Perhaps forced to get out. Seth Jones, Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Here's a recent headline in the Wall Street Journal. U.S. regulators go easier on mortgage lending rules. And the AP writes, with the financial crisis and subprime mortgage bust receding further into history, the government is loosening some financial rules, hoping to inject more life into the country's still recovering housing market. But an economist at the Securities and Exchange Commission, which made the new rules, warned against them, saying they mean that banks may have the same kinds of economic incentives they had before the financial crisis. What? Didn't anyone read Michael Lewis? As the New York Times writes, no one writes with more narrative panache about money and finance than Mr. Lewis, using his subject's stories to show the problems with the systems around them. His three books about Wall Street include last year's Flash Boys, The Big Short before that, and his classic Liar's Poker about his time working for Salomon Brothers. Liar's Poker is now out in a 25-year anniversary edition. We want to get Michael's thoughts on how far we may or may not have come, so he joins us from New York. Michael Lewis, welcome back to Here and Now.
Oh, well, thanks for having me back.
And what goes through your head when you hear a loosening of mortgage lending rules?
Well, you know, there are a couple. You have to examine it case by case. It may be that some of the rules are dumb. I don't think automatically, oh, my God, the industry's captured the regulators in this particular case. But I do think, I mean, I've so given up on the idea that regulators will regulate the financial industry. I think there's like a couple of real problems. And one of them is that, you know, when a person making $80,000 a year is trying to boss around someone making $2 million a year, it doesn't work very well. And the regulators generally have as their plan in life to go and work in the industry. So it feels like the relationship between the financial sector and the government regulators is essentially a collaborative one rather than an oversight one.
So you think there's a more system-wide problem than just these rules might reflect. But I just want to – there's some people who might need reminding, and I'm going to really simplify. You know, the whole collapse came about because people sold mortgages to people who couldn't afford them, and then they packaged and resold those mortgages hidden in financial instruments, which eventually collapsed, as I said, very simply put. But, you know, with your book having –
much worse than that.
Oh,
right?
Sure.
I mean, the Wall Street firms gamed the ratings agencies so they would call all this stuff riskless and made these products. It was so complicated that you couldn't tell what the risk was. You know, it was appalling.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I was simply putting it. But if we look back to your book 25 years ago, You were asked at Salomon Brothers to sell bonds that were going to collapse, and everybody knew it. And you had to secretly kind of tell one client, don't touch this with a 10-foot pole. So it seems as if it hasn't changed. Are you saying that it still hasn't changed?
Most of the changes I think that have happened on Wall Street are for the worse. Liar's Poker sort of describes a new world on Wall Street where these investment banks are now big corporations, where the finance has gotten so complicated outsiders can't understand it, and where the firms are taking these big bets with shareholders' money, and that's all new in 1988. The whole world's moved further in that direction. It's become much harder for an outsider to discern what goes on inside one of these banks because this stuff is now so complicated, and intentionally so. The whole idea of too big to fail didn't exist in the late 80s, and now it basically does. Mm-hmm. These institutions are basically beyond the rules of ordinary market rules. The connection that people in the industry feel to their firms is much fainter than it was then. It's a free agent. It's essentially a free agent society. So you've got a lot of people operating with very short-term interests in a business that really requires people to think in the long term if it's going to be sound.
Well, I just want to cap off, though, that what we started with, this idea that mortgage lending rules are being loosened a little recently. The Dodd-Frank law that was supposed to reform Wall Street required that the rules be reviewed, and the SEC chose what people are calling this looser option. But we're reminded that even Ben Bernanke recently, he's the former Fed chair, couldn't refinance his mortgage because of the tight rules. So there are some who say they do need some loosening. But to your bigger point, Michael Lewis, that you don't think that the industry can be regulated because of this cozy, incestuous relationship. How do you change that?
There's no practical solution to it because nobody's going to pay regulators what they need to be paid to actually be independent beings and not in the thrall of Wall Street. I think what you do is you encourage – I think the solution to Wall Street problems is encouraging the market to work there. So encouraging disruptive entrepreneurs to come in and say the business is being done wrong this way. The customers need to understand it, so we do it a different way. And you look at this like this mortgage rules story. The reason these mortgage rules have been imposed, and it may be draconian and in some cases irrational, and people aren't getting loans they should get loans – who should get loans because of them – is because basically the society doesn't trust Wall Street to do the business sanely. There's just been this collapse of trust in the industry. And it's because the industry has gotten very dysfunctional. The incentives of the individuals in the big firms is not great. And I think it's sort of like that's the way we should be framing this problem. How do we recreate trust in this industry? How do we reintroduce market forces so that people who behave badly fail? And people who behave well succeed, and then the regulators become somewhat less necessary. I think they're too necessary.
Is part of it having some of the regulation come from the Justice Department? Hardly anybody, and certainly nobody at a high level, has been criminally prosecuted under Eric Holder.
You know why? This is just the scandal of the financial crisis was how much of what was done is maybe strictly legal. I mean, you know that the firms are very, very good at figuring out behavior that is profitable, possibly socially damaging, but totally legal, I don't think it's the truth. The central truth of the financial crisis is that lots of people broke the law and they got away with it. I think the central truth is a lot of people did bad things they knew were bad things, but they figured out that they could get away with it because they can construe it as legal.
Yeah.
So the prosecutions were going to be very difficult to make, I think, always.
So the point there is change, again, some of the laws, some of the regulations. But meanwhile, we want to ask you before we let you go. You recently wrote a piece for Bloomberg News pointing out that despite what you're saying and despite your books, and maybe because of your books, there's a certain romance to it as well, young people are flocking to Wall Street. You're the title of the piece, The Occupational Hazards of Working on Wall Street. You say one moment you're a young grad, you have ideals. The next you're old, at work, gaming rating companies, designing securities to fail so they might make a killing off investors they dupe into buying them, rigging various markets. And you go on to say not everyone on Wall Street does this, but enough that it makes you wonder. Wow, what do you really think, Michael Lewis, about young people?
I think there are lots of great people on Wall Street. That's not the point of that piece. The point of that piece is that, look, occupation. There are pressures that exist in every job. In Wall Street, there's some very, very acute pressures. And young people who go into the business, I think, are not sufficiently aware of what they are, and they will shape you. And people will end up doing things they couldn't imagine themselves doing when they were young if it had been described to them when they were young. So you, and this is the problem of incentives on Wall Street, right? It's the problem of the problem of being encouraged to behave in a very short-term fashion, of not being attached to your employer for the long term, and so on and so forth. So what I think is that if people are aware of that, maybe we correct it. Maybe it's a moral problem with a moral solution.
Well, Millennials Heading to Wall Street, his classic is Liar's Poker. It's out in its 25th anniversary edition, and we'll link you to the Bloomberg piece, A Cautionary Tale. I guess he's just saying be aware. Michael Lewis, thank you so much for stopping in with us.
My pleasure.
The Federal Trade Commission is suing AT&T for allegedly misleading consumers who bought unlimited data plans. The FTC says AT&T promised millions of smartphone customers unfettered access to the internet, but then cut connection speeds by as much as 95% for customers that spent a lot of time online and used a lot of data. AT&T says the charges are baseless and that it's being completely transparent and has been. Jordan Weissman of Slate joins us from New York with more on this. Jordan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And put this in perspective first. How much time does someone have to spend surfing the web or using apps or whatever they might be doing on their phone before AT&T supposedly restricted access to the internet?
A lot of time. So for a 4G LTE user, for instance, they restricted it at about 5 gigs. That was the limit. I'm a journalist. I'm permanently attached to my phone. I don't use it that much. But here's how Verizon, actually, not AT&T, but Verizon had a really nice description of what you could do with 4 gigabytes of data. You could, quote, watch with 4 gigabytes, you can watch 300 minutes of video. You can surf 50 web pages daily, upload 10 pictures, stream 15 minutes of music, and send 50 emails every day. And actually, in the end, you would only use about 3.61 gigs at that
point. So it's hard to get to that point. But the FTC says that AT&T got thousands of complaints over the slow data speeds. How many people were impacted?
They're saying about 3.5 million people were impacted, and they were throttled at least 25 million times, which tells us that we're talking about a small but very hardcore subset of mobile data users.
And the FTC is suing, not saying that AT&T can't do this, but that they misled consumers, that they didn't give them adequate warning, although AT&T says, look, we told them about this years ago and said we were going to slow down speeds for certain people.
Yeah, absolutely. This is not about whether or not AT&T is allowed to throttle your service. It's about how much it has to tell you about its plans to do so and what kind of warning it has to give you. One of the really seemingly incriminating quotes from the complaint or the lawsuit that was filed is from a section talks about a focus group where AT&T was basically researchers were trying to figure out how customers would react to throttling. And they basically realized customers really hated this idea and they didn't think if you had unlimited service, you should have speed slowed down. And so they basically said less is more approach. Don't really say too much about this. And the FTC says essentially this isn't in the contract that this will happen. On the bill, it says some speeds might be slowed down, but it doesn't really specify when or how, or it didn't, at least for a while. And then on top of that, only people who get the text messages are people who are already approaching or who are getting text messages warning them about it are already approaching the limit. They say that's not enough. There has to be much clearer forewarning.
Just back up a little bit here because this is something that we're now seeing with cable and internet providers dealing with unlimited data plans and having to throttle back the speeds of these things. Did these companies not realize when they offered these unlimited data plans that they wouldn't have enough data to allow everyone to go at the same speeds that they were used to?
Well, you got to remember that AT&T was the first company to offer the iPhone.
Right.
They started offering these unlimited data plans very early on. It wasn't clear that these smartphones were going to take off the way they did. I think part of what's going on here is we're seeing the legacy of an old business model, and they're trying to kind of push people out of it into tiered data plans without actually alienating too many customers by saying you can't do this. And they probably can't have it both ways.
Jordan Weissman of Slate, thanks so much. This is Here and Now.
So do you remember what happened 2 years ago today? If you're in New Jersey and New York, you do. Hurricane Sandy devastated those states and the Mid-Atlantic coast, killing 147 people and causing billions of dollars in damage. Rockaway, that thin peninsula jutting into the ocean from Queens, was hit particularly hard. And 2 weeks after the storm, we spoke to Donovan Richards, then chief of staff to New York City Councilman James Sanders. Now, it's a shaky phone line. Everything was shaky then, but we asked about relief efforts.
FEMA did not arrive in a timely fashion, nor did the Red Cross. If it wasn't for everyday citizens, the Rockaways would be in a shape that is unfathomable.
But the Red Cross received a lot of praise for its response to Sandy from President Obama, from other officials and celebrities who all encouraged people to donate to the organization, and they did, more than $300 million. On television, the Red Cross called its own response to Sandy near flawless. Now, there are surely people who can point to the Red Cross being a lifesaver over the years, but a new NPR and ProPublica investigation has uncovered serious problems with the charity's response to Sandy and is raising questions about whether the organization's obsession with public relations hinders its ability to help victims. NPR's Laura Sullivan reported the story. She joins us now. Welcome, Laura.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
And give us the overarching. You spent months researching this. What did you find?
So NPR joined with ProPublica in this story, and we reviewed hundreds of pages of documents, including internal reviews and emails, interviewed top current and former officials. And what we found is really an organization that was struggling to meet the basic needs of victims. We found some surprising things, like an incident where the charity sent as many as 40% of its emergency response vehicles to press conferences rather than out into the field. There was another where they failed to show up as promised to open shelters, and another where in one instance they allowed sex offenders to hang out in a shelter's children's play area. In a storm weeks earlier, it even sent empty trucks to drive around to make sure to make it appear as though supplies were being delivered, even though they weren't.
That sounds incredible, sending empty trucks to make it look like supplies were being delivered.
Exactly. This was during Hurricane Isaac in 2012 in Mississippi, and it was days into the storm, and the bulk of the supplies still hadn't arrived. About 80 trucks were sitting empty in the parking lot, and officials ordered the drivers to ride around and make it look like they were delivering the supplies to people who needed it, even though there was little to nothing or nothing at all in the trucks. And one of the truck drivers who was one of the volunteers who had given his time, you know, his vacation time, as Red Cross volunteers do, to go do this, was said it was one of the worst experiences that he had had with the Red Cross yet. And a lot of top officials said, it, even in that storm, that they were really caught underprepared, undersupplied and understaffed.
Well, you say you talked to both current and former Red Cross officials for this investigation and reviewed hundreds of pages of documents. But these were internal documents. They weren't meant to be public?
That's right. These are the Red Cross's own internal documents, their assessments of themselves in the aftermath of both of these storms, Isaac and Sandy. And they really showed one document in particular was a lessons learned document that outlined some of these problems in the shelters. And another one that really called into question some of the logistics problems. One senior vice president said that multiple systems failed during the storm. These were very critical documents from top officials of the Red Cross at the Red Cross.
Well, and there were a lot of people, it seemed, who were becoming disillusioned. Among the people you talked to is Richard Reichenberg. Who's he?
Richard Reichenberg has been one of the top disaster responders for the Red Cross for 27 of the nation's worst disasters in the past 10 years. He's one of a handful of guys with the qualifications at the Red Cross to do this. And he actually resigned from the post in frustration. He did 20 years in the Navy. He joined the Red Cross because he wanted to help people. And he said that what he saw in Sandy really, he became really disillusioned with the organization and resigned afterwards. And I think we have a piece of tape from him.
It was just clear to me that they weren't interested in doing mass care. They were interested in the illusion of mass care.
So how does the Red Cross respond to all this?
So the Red Cross, says that, you know, at one point called Richard Reichenberg one of their most valuable assets. But at the same time, they don't agree with his assessment of the organization. and that of other top officials. They say that it was a terrible storm. It stretched their organization to the max, that they've changed a lot of things. But for the most part, they have, throughout that storm and others, done a fantastic job that they're proud of.
And I think we have some sound from Trevor Riggin, Vice President of Disaster Services for the Red Cross.
That's right.
I think, the volume of services and the speed at which we provided it speaks to the quality of service of our volunteers and staff that were on the ground. I think there are details both in the documents you have and in other documents you haven't seen that help us learn how to improve our processes.
Well, Laura, part two of your report airs tomorrow on Morning Edition. We highly recommend it. We're going to look beyond Superstorm Sandy and what happens now, to this organization. But just in the few seconds we have, did you hear from people who benefited from the Red Cross?
Certainly. Without question, tens of thousands of people were helped or handed a meal, stayed in a shelter that the Red Cross had set up, and a lot of people had good accounts. But I think the overall frustration was that the organization was promising something to the public that they were not delivering, actually, and as best they could on the ground.
We look forward to your report tomorrow. NPR correspondent Laura Sullivan, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, have you seen the latest viral video sensation? It's opening up a conversation about the harassment women can face just walking down the street. The video features a young woman dressed in a plain black T-shirt, leggings, walking down the street in New York City. She's not at all provocative. Everything's covered, not too tight. She's not swaggering, not looking at all to anything around her. But here is some of what she experienced for 10 hours.
Hey, what's up, girl? How you doing? Somebody's acknowledging you. Hey, beautiful.
Where were you this morning?
Hey, baby. Hey, beautiful. Where were you this morning? Someone's acknowledging you for being beautiful for 10 hours. Men actually walked up alongside her. Many shouted from far away. New York actress Shoshana Roberts is the woman in the video. She teamed up with viral video marketing agency Rob Bliss Creative and Hollaback. That's a nonprofit dedicated to ending street harassment. In the 10 hours Roberts walked around the city, she experienced more than 100 instances of verbal street harassment, and that doesn't include the whistles. It started a lot of conversations. What do you think? Does it surprise you? Does it hit home for you? Let us know. You can see the video, share your thoughts at hereandnow.org or on Twitter. I'm at hereandnowrobin. He's at Jeremy Hobson. Love to hear what you think.
Time now for the Here and Now DJ sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Aaron Bird is a DJ with KCRW in Santa Monica. He's back with us today. Aaron, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
And let's start with one of the songs you brought us. This is from the Los Angeles singer-songwriter Irene Diaz. The song is Crazy Love.
See, I follow you through the bluest of days. Hey, down.
What a voice on her.
Yeah, pretty amazing, right? Besides the absolutely captivating voice, I discovered her maybe about 2 years ago or so. She's a local talent straight from Highland Park here in Los Angeles. And there's just sort of this subtle dynamicism with her voice. I mean, it's absolutely captivating. And she's been touring somewhat regularly now around the country. And slowly but surely, she is becoming well known.
And how would you describe her style? She doesn't quite fit into a category as I listen.
It's interesting you say that, and people have asked me to describe her music, and I say if Fiona Apple and Norah Jones had a baby, it would be Irene Diaz.
But there's a tiny bit of country to her sound, I think.
Sure, sure, absolutely. I mean, she's told me that she's influenced by quite a few artists, including Ellen McIlwain, believe it or not. So I would say if you listen to the entire EP, which Crazy Love is featured on, titled I Love You Madly, you will hear a wide, wide range of influence and maybe pick up a bit more of the Norah Jones and Fiona Apple influence.
Well, from Los Angeles to Brooklyn we go now. And Busca Boya, this is the Puerto Rican designer Raquel Berrios and Luis Alfredo del Valle. Here is the song Caer. Now, on their Facebook page, Aaron, they say they're influenced by Argentinian 80s rock, Cuban psych. What do you hear?
I hear all of that. What's interesting about this particular release is they entered a contest put on by Guitar Center and Converse roughly about a year ago. And the first prize was that you would have an EP produced by Dev Hines, who's better known as Blood Orange. Blood Orange is a really interesting guy. He was formerly known as Champion Sound and now goes as Blood Orange. And it is very authentic 80s pop. But Busca Boya sound is probably a little bit more traditional mixed with psychedelic rock and a bit of a Caribbean flavor in there as well. And it's a really, really nice marriage between what you hear in Blood Orange's music and what you would hear in Busca Boya's music pre-Dev Hines influence. And it's really, really nice. I really, really love their sound and think there's good things in the future for them.
All right, well, staying with the 80s sound, let's get to a British artist. This is Julio Bashmore, and here is Rhythm of Old. Maybe we should have done these in reverse order so we could have our dance party and then we could relax with Irene Diaz. But tell us about Julio Bashmore.
It's so funny you say that. I was just thinking in my head, I was like, wow, it's a little bit more dancey than I thought I would be doing. Julio Bashmore, he is by far one of my favorite contemporary producers. He really burst out on the scene, I want to say it was around the end of 2010. That's when some of the DJs got this particular tune that he became known by. Since then, he's been discovered by a few other acts, most notably Jessie Ware. He did a lot of production on Jessie Ware's record, her debut release that came out a couple of years ago. And he's just recently returned with a few new singles of his own. And this particular tune, Rhythm of All, I have been listening to nonstop. I play it on repeat. It's just so damn groovy, and it's infectious, you know?
It is. It's a lot of fun, and it's probably got our listeners moving around in their cars or at their office or wherever they might be right now. But let's stay in the UK here for our next artist. This is the English singer-songwriter Nick Mulvey, and here is the song Juramadam. Too much time drinking whiskey and wine. The last couple's always like the first. Step in line, Rubik's with the vine. What is it that catches your ear about this song, Aaron?
I am a huge, huge fan of, I think, what most people would consider to be desert blues. There is a style of music that I guess most notably have been given credit to the Tuaregs, nomadic people from northern Mali, around the Timbuktu area. It is very, very clear that he's influenced by that style of music. And so that's what catches me initially, just the melodies of the West African string arrangements. And I was familiar with, he first came on the scene as one of the founding members of a group called Portico Quartet. And they have an interesting sound. He plays, in that band at least, an instrument called hang, which is this really weird flying saucer looking percussion instrument. It's a bit difficult to describe, but it makes this beautiful, beautiful sound. So I was familiar with that group, and this is his debut release, and I'm certain it's going to make my top 10 of 2014. It is an absolutely gorgeous record.
Well, we'll put a picture of that instrument up at our website, hereandnow.org. And let's move right along back to the U.S. and the Philadelphia electronic pop duo Marian Hill. Here is Got It.
Pulling a string, helping you unwind. You want to know, but it can't be tied. You want to steal, cause it can't be bought. I got this thing.
You know, there's a 90s sound to this. I almost think I'm listening to something that would come from Salt-N-Pepa or En Vogue.
Yeah, I think you absolutely called it. I was thinking about, before I stepped in the studio for this interview today, it's like, how would I describe this? I mean, I think for most people, they would maybe associate it with the genre of future soul, which is sort of in the same realm of Little Dragon. And last time I was on with you, I introduced a band called Aldego.
Yeah.
And I would say that because of their actual production approach, it's sonically more traditional hip-hop, more of that boom bap. And so they're less like Little Dragon and Aldego and more like Aaliyah and Mary J. Blige in that sense. Mm. So I think you're spot on with the En Vogue reference for sure.
Aaron Bird, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, with some music from all over the world, some great songs, and it's all at our website, hereandnow.org. Aaron, thank you.
Thanks so much, Jeremy. Look forward to the next time.
I got it.
And of course, you can go to Spotify and search for NPR Here and Now, and you can get the Here and Now DJ Sessions playlist on Spotify. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
You're crumbling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Institute of Contemporary Art with Hooked and Twisted, featuring the expressive possibilities of fiber art from vibrant weavings to massive sculptures on view now. ICABoston.org.